today, following Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn on the election campaign trail. And wildfires in Australia reach dangerous new levels. Has Boris Johnson given up booze for this campaign?
He claims to have done, but he has been spotted sipping little bits here and there along the campaign trail.
The Guardian's deputy political editor, Rowena Mason, has spent this election campaign crisscrossing the country on the tail of Conservative leader Boris Johnson, close enough to watch his daily habits and notice his optimism about the likely outcome.
And when I was on the Tory bus last week, Boris Johnson, in a huddle with journalists, started talking in Greek to us. He was in very cheerful, excitable form, and it just gave you the sense that even though he was saying that he wasn't really measuring the curtains yet and he refused to answer any questions about life in Downing Street, the impression he was giving was that he was pretty confident about where he was heading.
Political editor Heather Stewart has been travelling with Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn.
We know he loves travelling around on trains.
Watching how he keeps calm as the tension builds.
There was a picture on Jeremy Corbyn's Twitter feed, and it was him on a train down to an event on the coast in the southwest somewhere, and he was staring out of the train window at a lovely rainbow. And I thought that I could imagine his aides thinking, you know, this is a great way to sort of calm him down and get him back into that nice, twinkly, relaxed mood that where he answers questions well and comes over much better.
There are just 2 days to go until we vote in a momentous election. The decision made on Thursday could tip Britain straight into Brexit under a Conservative government that has shifted to the right, or see Labour offer a second EU referendum and immediately start to renationalise key industries. The choice has rarely been so stark. From The Guardian, I'm Anoushka Astana. Today in Focus, on the campaign trail with Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn. Heather, if you can, cast your mind back to the very start of this campaign. What was the mood like for the Labour leadership back then?
I went to their sort of launch event.
Today, we launch the most ambitious and radical campaign our country has ever seen.
And it was very upbeat, lively. It was in Battersea Arts Centre. It's a big audience. There was a real sense of sort of enthusiasm. Usual kind of Temptations soundtrack. And
Temptations?
Yeah, they love
what,
a bit
like?
Of sort of...
No. You mean The Temptations.
The Temptations, yeah.
I thought you were telling me about the song. Right, let's do this again.
I turned up about half an hour before it started, didn't get a seat, so I sort of stood at the back trying to, you know, sit cross-legged and file a story on my laptop and then leap up to ask Jeremy Corbyn a question. It's a Labour seat, but with a small majority, Battersea. The crowd there were absolutely passionate, wild. They were wild. There was a woman quite near me, a middle-aged woman, ululating, I think that's the word, which I can't do.
I don't know what that means.
Amazing. You know, but there was this real kind of almost desperation. Things can be better. Shouldn't things be better? Shouldn't we have a different kind of world? Which was, you know, the message that went down well in 2017. And here it was. It was like a sort of greatest hits feeling about it, really.
Boris Johnson. I knew you'd sit down as soon as I mentioned the name.
And the first week of the campaign didn't go well for the Tories, did it?
It was pretty disastrous because of Jacob Rees-Mogg's comments about Grenfell Tower when he was suggesting that people who took the advice of the fire service and stayed where they were lacking in common sense.
I think if either of us were in a fire, whatever the fire brigade said, we would leave the burning building.
That was the first real blow to their campaign. Since then, Jacob Rees-Mogg, a very close ally of Boris Johnson, has effectively been benched.
Do you know, I texted him, I think, just after he'd made those comments to see if he would do a Guardian event. And he replied, "Many thanks. That is a very tempting invitation, but I plan hardly to leave Somerset during the campaign."
And that has been borne out because he has only very rarely been spotted by several reporters that have been sent to look for him.
I think I saw a selfie at Stonehenge the other day.
Then there was another catastrophe, and that was that Alan Cairns, the Welsh secretary, resigned over some actions by one of his former aides in connection to a rape trial he was accused of sabotaging.
Today he wrote to the Prime Minister, "This is a very sensitive matter, and in light of continued speculation, I write to tender my resignation as Secretary of State for Wales." He added that he was confident he would be cleared of wrongdoing.
If you talk to Tory strategists now, what they say is that they really tried to be ruthless about dealing with those two incidents at the time, forcing Jacob Rees-Mogg to apologise straight away and then take him off the pitch. And then with Alan Cairns doing a similar thing, even though it was damaging to their campaign in Wales. That's the typical philosophy of Linton Crosby, who's a Tory election guru and a close friend of Boris Johnson, of getting barnacles off the boat. That's how it's being referred to internally.
And he may have got those barnacles off the boat, but it certainly didn't immediately improve. I mean, you were on the campaign trail, and one of the early things that seemed quite bad was there was major flooding across the north of England and the Midlands, and it took Boris Johnson quite a few days to get there.
We want to know, why has it took you so long, 5 days, Boris, to come and see us here?
It was really flat-footed of the Prime Minister to have taken quite a lot of time to get up to Yorkshire and to also seem to have minimised it as a problem.
Yes, we know. Where have you been?
Not saying it was a national emergency straight away. It seemed that the campaign was really floundering at that point.
Were Labour feeling quite smug at that point?
Yeah, I think they were. And I think there were aspects of this is a close team around Jeremy Corbyn who've effectively run a general election campaign before. And it really did feel in those early days that the Tories were making a series of sort of terrible missteps that Labour were able to capitalise on. And they also quite quickly alighted on this idea of connecting Brexit and Boris Johnson's version of Brexit with the threat to the NHS. So
we've now got evidence that under Boris Johnson, the NHS is on the table and will be up for sale.
Two very strong issues that they got out there early.
The person that's running the campaign for the Tories is a man called Isaac Levido. He is a former right-hand man to Linton Crosby and very much seems to be in the Crosbyite mould of running elections, which is safety first, and having a small number of slogans that you hammer away over and over and over again.
We can get Brexit done. We got 7 days to get Brexit done. Get it done by January the 31st and come out. Let's get Brexit done, my friends, and get on with our project.
Most people probably identify that with his campaign now. He's got quite a small number of policies, really, that he's talking about all the time, which are the 20,000 police officers.
We need safer streets in our country. We need to be getting crime down.
And the 50,000 nurses, which it subsequently emerged that not all of them will be new nurses. Quite a lot of them will be nurses retained. He's pared down the number of things that he's talking about to a very slim number of things, and that was reflected as well in the manifesto launch, which came quite late in the campaign, again to minimise the potential for mistakes.
Let's go for sensible, moderate, but tax-cutting, one-nation Conservative government and take this country forwards. Thank you all very much.
And it was really honed down into these very few areas that he wants to focus on. And of course, returning people to Brexit and this idea that the Conservatives will get Brexit done by January the 31st, even though, of course, it will drag on for years and years and years.
And Heather, in 2017, the digital campaign for Labour was a massive thing. Is that the same this time round again?
Yeah, you've still got people in Southside putting out very nice little slick videos. And also there's a videographer who goes around with Corbyn and takes slick little videos of him.
Big news. We've just launched our new manifesto. So I thought I'd take just 60 seconds to run through as many of the policies as I can.
Momentum is also putting out its own material, a lot of which is including, I think, more attacks against Boris Johnson, which is something that Jeremy Corbyn has tended personally to stay away from. In that first interview I did with him, he said, "They go low, we go high." But you've seen other senior Labour figures do that, and you've certainly seen that in a lot of this multimedia material.
To say Boris Johnson lacks a moral compass is like saying that the Flat Earth Society lacks an actual compass.
The Tories are really jealous, in fact, of Labour's incredible online output. But they have made some changes in comparison to previous elections. They've got these two young digital gurus from New Zealand, and one of their hallmarks is shaky camera videos of Boris Johnson talking about the way he likes his tea.
Hey, Boris, you all right?
I'm good. How are you?
What's been on your mind today?
The Prime Minister's been doing a lot of Facebook Live, direct-to-the-viewers type of mini videos that spread across Facebook.
Good afternoon. I'm speaking to you live from my desk in Downing Street.
And what media outlets are they going for? I mean, are you front of the line for interviews in The Guardian?
Afraid not. Front of the queue for media interviews have been The Sun, which had a full, absolute run-through day on the campaign trail with Boris Johnson.
How do you keep your energy up? 13-hour day.
I think it's genetic. I have a lot of energy.
Eat Haribos by the bunch load?
No, I don't. I sometimes succumb to flapjacks.
We haven't been given a chance to have an in-depth grilling of him, but we've had a couple of questions. We asked him about his reaction to the London Bridge terror attack and politicising it, which is what he was accused of in our pages by David Merritt, the father of Jack Merritt.
Prime Minister, Merritt's father, David Merritt, has said your response to the London Bridge attack has been beyond disgusting.
And you also got a question at the Tory manifesto launch that left the Prime Minister floundering. What was that about?
What happened was the Conservatives changed their Twitter handle from Conservative HQ to Fact Check UK. So they were masquerading, in effect, as an independent fact-checking organisation, and they got a whole heap of criticism for that, including from proper, authentic fact-checking organisations and Twitter itself.
Well, Rowena, I'm afraid that the Twitter sphere is not really my province. But what I can say is that I'm informed that the Labour have some sort of operation which is...
Were you nervous?
Yes, I was slightly taken by surprise because I was pretty sure he wasn't going to call me for a question. And he was sort of thrown off balance by the question and then sort of started pretending that he had no idea what I was talking about.
I will apprise myself of the detail of this. But, you know, when it comes to, as I say, when it comes to trust in politics...
And then rambling on about the hunting of the snark.
There is one elusive, like the hunting of the... of the snark, or the quest for the answer to Fermat's last theorem, or the riddle of the Sphinx, or the Bermuda Triangle.
He was like, Twitter? What's that? Nothing to do with me.
And the revealing thing is, actually, that I'd asked him exactly the same question a week earlier in an off-camera setting and explained exactly what had happened.
Do you think he made up that he didn't know what you were talking about?
Of course he did.
In terms of their media strategy more broadly, I mean, I was amazed that when we tried and failed to get Jeremy Corbyn on Today in Focus, they said they haven't spoken to a single podcast. So presumably it's quite traditional.
Yeah, I think it is quite traditional in a way. They've done plenty of those set-piece broadcast interviews, including, of course, that one with Andrew Neil that Boris Johnson has dodged.
Wouldn't you like to take this opportunity tonight to apologise to the British Jewish community for what's happened?
What I'll say is this. I am determined that our society will be safe for people of all faiths.
That was a side of Jeremy Corbyn. He was tired, I think. He can be a bit tetchy. He can be a bit defensive.
Can I explain what we're trying to do?
You have, and you've been given plenty of time to do it. I asked you if you wanted to apologise.
He can also be wry and warm and very, very happy to answer questions. I asked him a question last week at a press conference, otherwise about Brexit, about anti-Semitism. And, you know, he answered it very robustly. But in that Neil interview, you saw a less pleasant side of him. Unfortunately, that was the clip that then got shown on Have I Got News For You on the Friday night as a representation of Labour's campaign for that week.
Rowena, Corbyn clearly felt stung by his Andrew Neil interview, not least because Labour thought that Boris Johnson was going to do one as well. In fact, the Prime Minister, although he's done head-to-head debates, is refusing to do this despite all the other leaders putting themselves up for a grilling. That's bad, isn't it? Bad for the BBC and bad for him.
It's terrible, really, and an acknowledgement that Andrew Neil is a very ferocious interviewer.
Yeah, and I bet they were furious when Andrew Neil had a pop at Boris Johnson that went viral and has probably now been watched more on Twitter than the actual programme would have been.
We have an interview prepared, oven ready, as Mr. Johnson likes to say. The theme running through our questions is trust, and why at so many times in his career in politics and journalism, critics and sometimes even those close to him have deemed him to be untrustworthy.
It's just one of those things that I think that the Tory campaign will have taken the calculation that they can just get away with effectively, because quite a lot of people won't know Andrew Neil and the difference between him and other interviewers, and they might see him doing some other debates or some more softball programmes such as This Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Holly.
Philip Schofield and Holly Willoughby, although they were very tough on Jeremy Corbyn, and they did manage to get Boris Johnson to apologise over his comments about Muslim women wearing a full face veil being like letterboxes.
I think what people want to know is, what are we going to do now?
Yeah, no, what people want to know, if you're going to be Prime Minister, why would you say something like that?
Well, I think you know...
Corbyn does take a lot of questions at press conferences, and he does take questions from a wide set of publications. And I should also say, you and I have both been at press conferences in the past, I think, where journalists have been booed or criticised. And they've made a point at pretty much every press conference I've been to this time of saying... John McDonnell said it very strongly the other day, it's journalists' job to ask questions and we will not boo. I think it's dawned on them that that's not a very comradely approach and it's not a great look.
OK, so you're not front of the queue for a sit-down, but you have got up close and personal with Boris Johnson in this campaign, haven't you?
I wouldn't say that. I've been on his bus.
Tell me about his bus.
There's usually two of them. One has the broadcasters on it, one has the print journalists on it, and then Prime Minister travels separately in a privately chauffeured car. But we have been following him around. We went to a very safe Tory seat, actually, in Salisbury. He was allowed out by his minders to do a walk amongst the general public, and I think they wanted somewhere where the public would probably be more supportive of him than a marginal seat. He wandered around a Christmas market, and it was the middle of the day, so there was quite a lot of older people who seemed to be fairly excited about having selfies with him.
I lashed out on some sausages earlier on. Yeah.
But it was a mixed reception. There were a few people shouting, "Stop Brexit," or "Shame on you."
They're going to be perverts, we're going to have robbers.
How does he react to that?
He just ignores it. He just moves on and looks for the next photo opportunity.
Heather, one of the key parts of Labour's campaign seems to be these policy launches at which Corbyn might speak and take questions. What are they like?
Labour is good at running these events, right? So they're fairly slick. There's a theme to them. There's often a sort of handout document. There's usually the local candidate and perhaps one of a small group of prominent front benchers. So there's a kind of narrow group of people who have been rolled out in this campaign over and over and over again.
Who are they?
They are Rebecca Long Bailey, they are Angie Rayner, they are Richard Bergen. All of these are Northern voices. They're not super Remainy voices. So people like Keir Starmer and Emily Thornberry, for example, who we heard from a lot during the travails in Parliament, though we've heard a lot less from them.
Do you ever get on the bus?
I have had one brief moment on the bus. They don't make a habit of taking journalists out on the bus. In a way, it's a kind of private space for Jeremy Corbyn to be able to relax and for them to be able to talk about strategy and deal with issues. They're not into...
Pesky journalists.
No, absolutely not. So there was one occasion where I was offered a quick interview with Angela Rayner. It was when Labour launched its National Education Service and this chance to go back into education later on in life. Angie Rayner gave a speech and they said, well, yes, you can interview her, but only if you jump on the bus, which took us from Blackpool Football Club to the town centre. I think I looked at my tape afterwards and it was sort of 12 minutes of conversation with her, and somewhere a little bit further down the bus was Jeremy Corbyn talking to his aide.
It's often very early starts and then you're sort of shipped out somewhere and you're not quite sure where you're going because the advisors are keep it very close. But usually these kind of events are held in workplaces like a factory of a Brexit supporting businessman. And so the workforce there, even though they're given a question and answer session, they're not really incentivised to ask anything particularly testing or tough. Although the exception to that actually was up in Teesside. He was at a depot. And some of the questions there were really tough. One of them asked, are you going to cut taxes for everybody?
Low tax. Do you mean low tax for people like you or low tax for people like us?
And that question caught him so off guard that he accidentally let slip one of his major manifesto policies, which was that he was planning to raise the national insurance threshold.
We're going to be cutting national insurance up to 12.
Everything pointed to it having been a mistake. The advisors were sort of thrown into disarray and pulling broadcast interviews while they got him up to speed on what the policy actually was.
It must be interesting to watch how Jeremy Corbyn's advisors behave around him.
there was one event that I arrived at and I'm sort of wandering in with my laptop and bits of paraphernalia getting ready, and an aide comes out and sort of shuffles me out of the way because Jeremy's about to arrive.
What, physically?
With a lot of hand gestures, a lot of sort of beckoning, because Jeremy's about to arrive and they want a nice clear shot of him coming into the building because that's part of the footage they want. They have police protection for the campaign. And I think his aides quite enjoy that. They say, you know, you're bound to get there on time because you've got these police outriders who make sure that you get up and down the M1 in double quick time or whatever.
And obviously, I was joking about you getting up close and personal to him, but you have been able to watch Boris Johnson at fairly close quarters during this election campaign. And historically, he's always kind of used his charisma to get out of difficult, awkward situations, you know. When he was abroad during the London riots, he came back brandishing a broom and suggesting he was helping the cleanup. He got stuck on a zit wire and just sort of managed to laugh it off. Do you think since he's been Prime Minister, all of that doesn't really work for him?
He hasn't played the clown quite so much, but off camera, he's still sort of joshing around and very different from previous Prime Ministers who would always maintain some degree of distance. On the campaign trail, a lot of the reaction of the public is to sort of see him as some sort of long-lost friend. They all, you know, shouting Boris, Boris at him and trying to get a selfie or trying to give him a hug. And then on the other hand, you get a very visceral, angry reaction from people shouting shame and liar and protesting outside all of his events.
Does that bother him?
Talking to people close to him, yeah. I think his image of himself is very different from other people's image of him. He was used to, when he was Mayor of London, feeling like he was a sort of populist politician, but people have such strong feelings about the referendum and his behaviour in it. I think it came as a shock to him after that point that he wasn't as popular as he remembered during his mayoral campaigns.
And perhaps most prominently in recent times, very serious questions about his relationship with Jennifer Arcuri, who it appears that he had an affair with over 4 years. And yet she was winning contracts that were linked to the Mayor of London.
While he's been shrugging off these accusations about his personal life in front of the cameras, it is something that Labour candidates have been exploiting a lot on the doorstep. Several of them have told me that he doesn't go down well with women voters in particular, and that every opportunity they're bringing up his personal relationships, including his inability to answer the question of how many children he's got. And they claim that this is something that really is quite off-putting to women voters.
Heather, have you ever seen Labour candidates mention Boris Johnson's personal life on the doorstep?
I have seen it. I haven't seen Jeremy Corbyn do it. And that's something it's really important to remember, is that while I'm trailing Jeremy Corbyn around looking at the sort of overarching strategy and the overarching message, individual candidates are very much honing their own messages on the doorstep and using whichever aspects of Boris Johnson's disadvantages they can.
How does Jeremy Corbyn get treated by the public when you've seen him walking around?
So it's very divided. I've been on events with him where he gets an incredibly warm reception, a bit like we saw in 2017. And then other occasions, so the day when I interviewed Angie Rayner, and then we sort of stopped the Labour bus in Blackpool town centre and I sort of stood around for a bit while he gave a bit of a speech. And I mean, there was a car that slowed down and rolled down the window, beeped its horn, and a number of rude gestures were made out of the passenger window. There was another woman who came up and berated one of Jeremy Corbyn's advisers about, you know, how could he lay a wreath at the Remembrance Sunday service when he doesn't support our troops. It was a very short stop. It was only 5 or 10 minutes, but there was a lot of hostility there. You know, he acknowledges this, asked him about this. Liz Bates from Channel 4 asked him. I've been talking to working class voters up and down the country, and a lot of them say, I don't like that Jeremy Corbyn, which is something candidates say you hear on the doorstep. And he said, some people like Marmite and some people don't like it, but I think it's good for you. It was one of the few tongue-in-cheek moments of the press conference, but it was a sort of a wry acknowledgement that he is quite a divisive figure and he knows he doesn't go down well in every household in the country.
Rowena, Corbyn is admitting that he's divisive on the doorstep, and it's pretty clear from what you've said to us that the same is true for Boris Johnson. People either want to get a selfie with him or berate him as an offensive liar. As we reach the end of this campaign, it seems that the Tories are pretty confident. Yesterday, Johnson was at a fish market in Grimsby, which hasn't had a Tory MP since 1945. But as you say, it's not been a perfect campaign, has it?
In terms of the polling, since the beginning of the campaign, the Conservatives have dropped slightly and Labour have gone up. So the gap in the polls has narrowed, but not as much as it did in the 2017 campaign. And with a few days to go, the gap is still possibly enough for Boris Johnson to win a majority.
Heather, we're calling you late on Monday because I know you've made it onto the Labour bus again. You've been out with Jeremy Corbyn interviewing him for The Guardian. And it's interesting because we've just been hearing about how Labour remains stubbornly behind in the polls. What's the mood?
Well, Jeremy Corbyn seemed very relaxed today. I have to say, I was speaking to him after a big rally he did in Bristol, which is really a sort of geeing up the activists type event. You know, there were, I guess, you know, a couple of thousand people there. It was very upbeat. He gave a speech, lots of cheering, you know, lovely sunny day, home crowd feel to it. And he was quite relaxed on the bus, quite chatty. You know, at one point we're going through this lovely countryside on the outskirts of Stroud and he kind of breaks into what sounds like the sort of commentary on a coach tour, you know, and on your right, ladies and gentlemen, you know. And so he was very relaxed. Perhaps because this is coming to an end, I don't know. So I asked him, of course, what would you do on Friday morning if you don't win? You know, there's been speculation that you might step aside. Won't address that question at all. We're fighting this to win it. And we also talked about one of the big stories in the news today, which is this poor little four-year-old lad who was pictured on the front of the Daily Mirror this morning, lying in a corridor in a hospital in Leeds with tubes and things coming out of him because there weren't any beds. And there was a very odd incident this morning where the Prime Minister was shown a picture of the little boy by a television journalist and sort of refused to look at it on his phone. It was very odd and took the reporter's phone away from him and put it in his pocket, which was just sort of felt like a sort of symbolic moment. So I asked Jeremy Corbyn about that, who, you know, said he wouldn't have behaved like that and he thought it was very odd, but interestingly didn't do what a lot of politicians would have done and really go for Johnson over it. And, you know, I said to him, should you have attacked Boris Johnson more? This is something you hear from Labour insiders quite a bit. Why are we really not going for Johnson? You know, why do we not attack him? And I said to Jeremy Corbyn, is it hard to land blows on Boris Johnson? And he really sort of made a bit of a face at me, didn't look impressed at all, and said, I'm not a boxer. You know, perhaps some people would like me to be more attacking and that, but it's not my style. And it's quite interesting because it seems to me to sort of encapsulate quite a bit about the way Labour has fought this campaign, really.
That was political editor Heather Stewart and deputy Rowena Mason. You need to be following them and the rest of their brilliant Westminster team, including Andrew Sparrow with his politics live blog over the next few days and beyond. Go to theguardian.com. Coming up, Guardian Australia's Gabrielle Jackson on life under wildfire smoke. Now, wildfires are not new for Australia, but this year, the sheer scale and distribution of fires is affecting the country like never before. But while smoke-filled cities and burning rainforests are provoking an unprecedented national conversation on climate change, Guardian Australia's Gabrielle Jackson isn't sure that politicians or the media are listening.
The smoke smells like everything is on fire. It's like an acidic kind of metallic taste in the back of your throat. I've lived in Sydney for 30 years. I've never seen anything like it. The city is just covered in thick blankets of smoke that kind of get into your lungs. I've woken up and thought my house was on fire. I actually had to get up out of my bed and check every window to see if fires were burning around me because the smoke was so thick in my house. These fires are unprecedented in terms of the number of hectares burnt. The area that has burnt so far since the start of this fire season is 2.9 million hectares. That's bigger than Wales. Australia has always had bushfires, but usually it's been a concern of people who live in the country or live in forested areas. Now that the smoke is descending on cities, it's really felt all the way around the country. And it's not just that the fires are happening in one place, as is usually the case. Fires are happening in Western Australia, South Australia, Victoria, Tasmania, New South Wales and Queensland all at the same time. What's burning now is wet eucalypt forests and actually subtropical rainforests. We've never seen fires of this intensity in the places that they're burning now. And it's got severe effects on the ecosystem and the ecology of those areas. In one part of northern New South Wales, they predict that about 350 koalas have died. Eucalypts have evolved to regenerate quickly, but the fires are so hot that ecologists actually don't know how long it will take to regenerate this time and whether the koala population there can even survive. Australia has been in quite severe drought in eastern parts of the country for at least 5 years. There's so much dry matter on the ground that can catch a light easily, either through lightning strikes or through things like electricity, power lines falling down and sparking fires. You know, you can't draw a direct line between climate change and these particular bushfires, but climate change will make bushfires more severe and more intense, and they make the bushfire season longer. So what we saw this year for the first time is the first week of spring, a subtropical rainforest in Queensland was on fire. That's crazy. We have a situation in Australia where the climate change debate has become really party political. For 10 years, the Conservative government coalition has just not been able to come up with a real climate change policy. 6 years ago, they beat Labor on the back of a promise to repeal a carbon tax that a Labor government had put in place. A lot of the media is in support of the government not having a real climate change policy. It's hard to see how things can change. But the school climate strikes, I think, have been really positive in terms of how many people have turned out and how strongly young people feel about this issue. And for that reason, I think it's not possible for Australian governments to continue for much longer without some kind of policy.
That was Gabrielle Jackson, Associate News Editor at Guardian Australia. Before we finish today, I want to tell you that recently our very own Axel Cucutier won the Gold Award for Best Sound Designer at the Audio Production Awards, beating an amazing lineup of nominees. I hope you can tell from our Today in Focus episodes just how brilliant he is. We're really proud of him. That's it for today, but keep listening as we take you through this momentous political week. My thanks to Heather Stewart, Rowena Mason and Gabrielle Jackson. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cucutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.